In the first exploration of God's punishment, Measure for Measure, we focused on the first two plagues, blood and frogs, as punishment for the drowning of Israelite children. We concluded with analysis of God's last act of punishment and its Measure for Measure component, drowning the Egyptian military in the Red Sea, Measure for Measure, drowning for drowning. In this presentation, we will leave the nightmarish visions of malodorous, riding dead fish and frogs, and move on to the final two plagues, darkness and the death of the firstborn. Darkness, the ninth plague, was the greatest Egyptian nightmare yet, where in the Egyptians' vision was entirely obscured by darkness so thick as to be palpable. Classical biblical commentaries wondered why darkness was the penultimate plague preceding the Exodus. The Midrashim suggests that darkness was a convenient cover for several unrecorded events that God had not wanted Egyptians to see. These events were preparatory for the upcoming Exodus. Midrash Shemos Rabbah, for example, claims the Israelites used the cover of darkness to search Egyptian households for hidden wealth. This was in preparation for the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham, Genesis 15, verse 14. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great wealth. And God told Moses to command the Israelites, Exodus 13, verse 22, each woman shall request from her neighbor and the lodger in her house objects of silver and gold and clothing, and you shall put these on your sons and daughters, thus stripping the Egyptians. The secret home visitations enable them to preempt any claims that we have nothing to give. Another Midrash postulates that 80% of the Israelites chose not to leave Egypt or were otherwise unworthy of being part of the Exodus. The cloak of darkness hid their burials and kept their deaths out of the view of Egyptians. Neither of these Midrashim accords with the Exodus text. Let us now examine the penultimate plague, darkness, second only to the death of the firstborn. Darkness, after all, delivered no concrete act of destruction. Why should it stand higher in the plague pantheon than locusts or wild beasts or hail and fire? Let us carefully review the biblical narrative. Exodus 10, verses 21 through 23. Then the Lord said to Moses, hold out your arm toward the sky that there may be darkness upon the land of Egypt, a darkness that can be felt. Moses held out his arm toward the sky, and thick darkness descended upon all the land of Egypt for 3 days. People could not see one another, and for 3 days no one could get up from where he was, but all the Israelites enjoyed light in their dwellings. The biblical language indicates that this darkness was not simply the absence of light. It had a physical substance. It was a darkness that can be felt. This plague was not the darkness of a solar eclipse blocking the light rays of the sun. The darkness was unique, an entity unto itself. Exodus 10, verse 22, Moses held out his arm toward the sky, and thick darkness descended upon all the land of Egypt for 3 days. Now imagine, a powerful black hole does not allow even light to escape. Its gravitational pull that is so powerful that for 3 days no one could get up from where he was. This plague of darkness was not a negation, but rather a creation brought to the fore by the mighty hand of God. We are left still to explore how the plague of darkness reflected oppressive slavery. In what way did the plague of darkness fit the crime of enslavement? I refer you to the slave experience and narrative of the brilliant orator Frederick Douglass to provide insight. Douglass was a rebellious slave, one who had learned to read and write, a dangerous accomplishment in the eyes of the slaveholders. As a result, his master loaned him for an entire year to a slave breaker named Covey. Covey's task was to break and re-educate or uneducate Douglass while working him to his physical and psychological limits. In his powerful autobiography, Douglass articulated the symbolism of pervasive and weighty darkness. Frederick Douglass writes, Mr. Covey succeeded in breaking me. I was broken in body, soul, and spirit. My natural elasticity was crushed. My intellect languished, the disposition to read departed. The cheerful spark that lingered about my eye died. The dark night of slavery closed in upon me, and behold, a man transformed into a brute. For the slave, the darkness was interminable. No day dawns for the slave, nor is it looked for. It is all night, night forever. The darkness that ascended on Egypt was all-encompassing, chaining the populace as though they were enslaved, leaving them totally powerless and ineffective, isolated, without family or friends. To paraphrase Douglas for these 3 days, no day dawned for Egyptians. It was all-encompassing night. As days passed, it seemed like night forever. In the words of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, this was, quote, the most complete and comprehensive oppression imposed on the Egyptian people, end quote. In darkness, the Egyptians experienced measure for measure the physical and psychological helplessness, hopelessness, and isolation of slavery. Now let us turn to the 10th and final plague, death of the firstborn. God spoke to Moses while on the journey with his family towards Egypt, where he would confront Pharaoh. This prophetic vision was revealed shortly before Moses met up with his brother Aaron, who was to be the spokesman on behalf of the Israelites in place of a reluctant Moses. In that meeting, Exodus 4, verses 22 to 23, God said, "You shall say to Pharaoh, so said God, my firstborn son is Israel. So I say to you, send out my son, that he may serve me. But you have refused to send him out. Behold, I shall kill your firstborn son." This is the clearest articulation of God's justice measure for measure. The Israelite nation was God's firstborn nation. God chose Abraham and his progeny to be given the responsibility of being the first and primary disseminators of monotheism. They were to become a living national example, God's system of right and wrong, good and evil, holy and profane. Pharaoh's unrelenting enslavement of the Israelites prevented the chosen people from assuming and fulfilling their national mission and divine destiny. Punishment for continued enslavement of God's firstborn was, measure for measure, the death of Pharaoh's own firstborn, along with the firstborn of all his people. The firstborn were chosen because of primogeniture. It was they who usually inherited a larger portion of the ancestral estate. Furthermore, the firstborn carried the name, the power, and the values of the forebears from generation to generation. The Bible records the plague's impact, Exodus 12, verses 29 through 30. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And Pharaoh rose in the night with all his courtiers and all the Egyptians, because there was a loud cry in Egypt, for there was no house where there was not someone dead. The obliteration of Egypt's next generation of leaders finally broke Pharaoh's spirit of defiance and abolished the support of his people. For each of them, there was no house where there was not someone dead. Contrast this with the closure of American slavery. There was no comparable punishment experienced by the leaders of the slaveholder class or the political and military leadership of the South. Retribution for Southern slaveholders was measured primarily in economic consequences. By far, the single most important consequence was the loss of their most valuable capital assets, their slaves. In 1861 and 1862, the U.S. Congress passed confiscation acts that authorized the government to confiscate property and free the slaves of active supporters of the South's rebellion, especially those in leadership roles. There was some discussion of placing the Confederate leadership on trial. In fact, not a single Confederate leader was tried for secession, rebellion, or treason. Jefferson Davis was captured and incarcerated for 2 years, awaiting trial for treason but was never tried. In May 1865, President Andrew Johnson pardoned en masse the overwhelming majority of Southerners, excluding only the wealthiest slave owners. However, These wealthy landowners were urged to request personal pardons. President Johnson signed 13,500 individual pardons before the year's end. And finally, on Christmas Day, 1868, President Johnson issued a blanket pardon to all those who had not been covered by previous actions. And unlike the next generation of Egyptians who died on Passover Eve, the post-war generation of Southerners regained their economic leadership and political power within a generation. This was in part because leaders such as Abraham Lincoln believed the cause of reuniting a broken country was more important than retribution. Lincoln concluded his second inaugural address with, quote, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan," end quote. God had no such plans for national reconciliation between Israel and Egypt as part of the Exodus. He built on the slave experience to develop an Israelite nation whose people individually and collectively approach the poor, the stranger, or the slave with empathy and act to mitigate their poverty and sense of powerlessness. As we recall, we live and celebrate the Exodus and acknowledge God's justice measure for measure. I find it interesting to include God's coda to the Egyptian sojourn. 40 years after the Exodus, as the Israelites prepared to enter Canaan, God commanded, "Lo tisavev mitzri kiger ha'yisav arzo, bonim asher yivoldu lahem dor shvishi, yavol lahem b'kal Hashem. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, for you are a stranger in that land. Children born to them may be admitted to the congregation of Hashem in the third generation." In the next recording, I will expand on the topic of God's justice measure for measure. The focus will be on Lincoln's words, quote, "Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk," end quote. I look forward to sharing with you this further exploration of God's justice as it relates to the destruction of slaveholder wealth and compensation for enslavement. This is Kenneth Chelst, and thank you for listening.